Reality Exploit Roundtable is filmed in front of a live studio audience.
Yep, okay, everybody go.
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 Hold on a second. Done.
All right, rolling.
Hello and welcome to Reality Episode... Oh, shit.
I say we keep that in for the real show.
All right, let's try that again.
When all you have is a search engine, everything looks like a database.
Man, I have like a cypherpunk hard on right now.
Privacy is nothing to be granted. Privacy is something you take yourself.
They've got the Mossad, the CIA, and Hillary Clinton behind them.
We're now beyond what the Stasi could even dream of.
Reality Exploit Roundtable.
Hello and welcome to Reality Exploit Roundtable, episode 14. This is Plato, and I will be your moderator for the day. We got a full cast on today of Hero, Smuggler, Voodoo, and Wise Guy. Say hello, everybody.
Hello, hello everybody.
Hello, Ryan.
Sweet. So yeah, a bunch of stuff's been happening since our last couple episodes, and we'll kick it off with Wise Guy. On 15th of October, the Dutch Ministry of Justice and Security proposed powers for the police to break into computers, install spyware, search computers, and destroy data. These powers would extend to computers located outside the Netherlands. Furthermore, providing the government the power to break into computers provides a perverse incentive to keep information security weak. Millions of computers could remain badly secured because the government does not have an incentive to publish vulnerabilities quickly, because it needs to exploit these vulnerabilities for enforcement purposes. So that's from bof.nl. And the first thing that comes to mind for me is that governments hack people all the time already. Look at Stuxnet, look at Flame. They're likely to continue to do so regardless of whether it's legal or not. But if they do legalize it, I could certainly see the Dutch cybersecurity agencies expanding their hacking operations a bit. So you could say that right now cyber warfare is covert. Laws like this raise the possibility of cyber warfare becoming overt. So, Wise Guy, can you offer us a forecast of the future of cyber warfare?
Well, it's a big and growing business. Now, back in 2003, many people laughed at U.S. Senator Orrin Hatch's proposal to create a technology to damage computers of people downloading and sharing music online. Well, they're no longer laughing. And I think the first huge step in that direction happened in 2007 when Estonia's internet infrastructure was attacked by what was believed to be either Russian intelligence agency people or Russian criminal gangs supported by or quietly encouraged by the KGB or the FSB. This whole area of creating a non-kinetic means of waging war in another country has become a major funded effort in world powers. As you mentioned, with the Stuxnet and Flame, those really showed a proof of concept that cyber war was not only theoretical but practical when it was used. The Stuxnet was used to damage the capability of Iran to purify nuclear materials. So I think this is the opening shots have already been fired, and we're going to see more and more of this. The question is, how does the political infrastructure and the military infrastructure in these countries deal with non-kinetic attacks? At what point will a country decide that a cyber war attack is every bit as an act of war as a kinetic attack? I think this is coming very soon. It's going to be a very interesting time ahead.
Well, There's already a significant difference in the rule of law between what happens when a state initiates a cyber attack and private individuals. In our show notes, you can find a link to a Glenn Greenwald comment where he's comparing the prosecution of anonymous DDoSers versus WikiLeaks. And he points out that all these guys who just, you know, turned on their low ion orbit cannon and DDoS Visa or somebody, they're all facing, you know, maximum 10-year prison terms. And when the government does it, when the government is hacking people, there's you know, it's not a bad thing. So as far as cyber, like legitimate wars between nations, I could see them both banding together to try and find and criminalize the terrorists who are, you know, not a state but are still, you know, making cyber attacks. Hero, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, you said that something about the states. Well, right now, and if you read most of the news, if you're Iran or China and there's anything that you do in any way along these lines, it's, of course, absolute. It just balls out terrorism. And then if you're the U.S. or one of the other countries, then, you know, it's called something else. But one interesting thing about the cyber war is a lot of focus lately has been on in the military, and even in some of our shows, the big thing going on right now is drones. And I ran across this article yesterday that there was this contest that's called the Drone Games. It was an article on spectrum.ie.org. And what was funny about they had these drone war things and all these drones. The one that got first place was a drone that actually infected other drones with a virus and took them over or something like that. So it was funny that even when the drone wars, you still have cyber war happening with the drones themselves.
Well, didn't this happen apparently with Iran when they claimed to have downed one of the U.S. drones? And there was a strong suspicion that with the support of Russian equipment, they were able to jam or neutralize either the satellite links and or the GPS links that the drones depended upon in order to figure out where they were and what they were supposed to do in this situation. And as a result, they were able to convince the drone with false GPS signals that a landing space in Iran was really its home base, and the drone just took to landing in Iran and not being damaged at all. They didn't have to shoot it down. They captured it intact.
I'm going to toss a link in our show notes to a blog post by the guy who made this Wi-Fi hack drone. It was for the Lawfare Drone Smackdown, which is like a brawl between all these guys. They built their drones, and the objective is to, you know, be the last drone standing. And this is from September, but he has an excellent write-up about the contest and about the tactics he used. And entertainingly, he has his 11-year-old and 14-year-old kids who are actually doing the real-time hacks with some scripts they wrote. So I'll drop that in the show notes. Smuggler, I interrupted you. You have anything to add?
Yeah, I just wanted to turn the thing back to the Dutch report there on the Netherlands wanting to hack foreign computers. I think we're not talking about cyber warfare here, because what the Dutch really want to do is to use state trojans against private people, not against governments, and specifically do that for systems, criminal systems, so to speak, that they cannot reach. And one of the examples for that was early this year, the Dutch hacked several nodes on the Tor network that were providing hidden services and distributing things that were illegal. So the Dutch police couldn't find the computers. So instead of finding them by tracing the network, which was not that easy on Tor, they hacked into the application that was offered and thus traced back the machines or destroyed them. So I actually think that what the Dutch are doing here is something else than cyber war. It is more or less an attack on darkness. They want to be able to infect machines on Darknets and destroy them or trace them back. Because they simply don't know where those machines are, they cannot say, okay, they're in our jurisdiction, so we want to have jurisdiction for the whole planet and to be able to attack those systems. So it's not cyber war, it's the war on darknets here.
So
yeah,
is this going
I agree. I agree. This is a police thing. This isn't a military thing. Police... law enforcement outfits around the world really, really, really hate the fact that we have encryption, that we can talk to one another, especially across borders, without having to go through their gateways, or even if we're going through their gateways, they can't monitor the conversations. And so it's dark nets like Tor, like I2P, they are going to be the targets for the foreseeable future.
Exactly. And what they hate, in addition to not being able to listen, is not being able to find and project force, because essentially anonymity is breaking their concept of what a state should do, because a state is nothing else but a set of rules that are enforced by violence. And if you don't know where to beat someone up because that person is anonymous, then the whole concept of state fails. So that is the Dutch solution to what happens if anonymity becomes widespread. And their solution is, you know what, it's global jurisdiction and we attack the machines and break into them and try to trace them back or to destroy them, because you know what, this anonymity thing is breaking our concept of violence.
Nice.
So do you think, Smuggler, that these networks or their follow-ons will be able to avoid these kinds of attacks?
Well, the problem with the attacks is that if you're on one of those networks offering stuff, then you will always be attacked because your stuff is public. I mean, there are friend-to-friend darknets and there's security, so to speak, firewalls on darknets, if you want, that make it harder. But if you want to offer something, you have to open yourself up to a potentially unknown party that might be an attacker. So I think the attack within darknets by criminal groups, by intelligence agencies, by law enforcement, and so on, that is something that will be part of the future of darknets, and it's just a new reality. And the only thing the Dutch do, they legitimize it and put it on paper so they have an excuse, and also to create a precedent for other states to come into the game. And no, there will be not a good solution for that. It will be just the same security fights we have on the internet today. And it will just spill over to the darknets, which has been foreseeable for a while now. And of course, this is kind of connected to the war of machines or cyber war or whatever. But I think this is a whole different approach here. This is the approach of law enforcement against people that escape the state.
That's excellent. I would like to touch on a little bit of tradecraft here, since you brought up this fact of them having difficulty locating the machines and tracing their location or the people involved. And so they want to actually hack the application or the operating system or some level of the stack that the people are using to run their application. One thing, and I'm not an expert on this, so Smuggler maybe or someone else might want to jump in on this, but there are some things that you could do when you start thinking about like firewall setups and demilitarized zones and those type of things, is if you're running a server, maybe let's say that the machine gets hacked, and then if you say, okay, well, if this gets hacked, then the database is accessed and all this, but at a worst case, I still don't want the location of my hidden server to be found by the fact of them getting in the machine and shutting down Tor and then accessing the internet and tracing themselves back outside the system. So maybe you could have the application server running actually behind another physical firewall. So if that machine was 100% compromised that we were running the hidden server on, they would be looking at, you know, trying to get back out on the internet through a connection that would be some type of like, you know, super BSD firewall type thing that, that is not running any extra stuff at all. That's really super, super, super hardened. And then, so they would be like stuck basically in a tar pit there.
Yes.
Yeah, you're touching on something that's really important there. But the thing really is you have to take the darknet routing and the darknet connection onto another machine than your application. So essentially you don't have Tor on the machine that offers your hidden service website. So you, what you want to prevent is that the application server has any connection to the normal internet, and that you have a different machine that runs Tor or ITP or whatever that firewalls only for incoming connections over Tor, and everything else is blocked. So you have to separate that and not just put a firewall in there that only allows Tor out. Because the problem is, as soon as you have control over the darknet program, you can modify the darknet program to make it traceable, and that is quite trivial. So you have to separate those two. And if you really want to make it real tough, it there's some sense of not relying solely on Tor or ITP, but have it itself run through a VPN or have it run through LTE or whatever, some to harden the path even more. Don't rely on a single technology there.
Do you guys know if there's any applications or projects that are designed to distribute an application? Could we have like 100 people who are all running their own servers with Tor nodes and they're all doing some shared computing with an application? So no one of them has total knowledge of the, you know, maybe the state of the program, and certainly they wouldn't have total knowledge of the data. But maybe there's got to be some way to have a bunch of people coordinating for this distributed app.
Yeah, it's called homo computing, homomorphic computing, or something like that.
Homomorphic.
Nice. I will have to look at that in more detail.
It's not ready yet. It's not ready yet. Don't waste your time. It's not ready. It's a little bit more in the future.
All right, well, I'll keep my eyes open.
Let me jump in one more thing here, Plato. What Hero and...
All right, you got the last word.
Okay, what Hero and Smuggler were talking about here really points to then is if your Tor network, whatever your dark net is, it's only as secure as the least secure hidden service that's running on there. You know, that's the tradecraft's fine for your own application, but if you are a node in that network and someone else doesn't harden their application, then that opens you to vulnerability.
To a point, yes.
Yeah, it seems pretty tricky. Good luck to anybody who is using your hidden services for important stuff. All right, let's proceed. Let's proceed to DRM schemes for 3D printers. So, somewhat unsurprisingly, a new patent issued by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, entitled Manufacturing Control System, describes a system whereby 3D printer-like machines, covering additive, subtractive, extrusion, melting, solidification, and others, they'll have to obtain authorization before they're allowed to print items requested by the user. So the idea here is that your printer has a chip in it, and your printer will refuse to print stuff unless you purchase the rights to the object that you're trying to print from whoever owns the copyright, who will probably be Disney or Viacom. Now, obviously, you could still build a 3D printer without a DRM chip. None of them have DRM chips now. They work fine. So it seems plausible that maybe governments would outlaw the non-DRM printers in an effort to enforce these copyrights. But I mean, they could all print out a large portion of their own parts. You just need some like threaded rod in the circuit boards. So Voodoo, is trying to police copyright on objects a losing battle or what?
I think it is a losing battle, but not in that way. The home 3D printer is just going to be used for things like can openers and such. The problem is these DRM chips are going to show up in like Xerox type machines. You know, the high end 3D printers that are being used for rapid prototyping or whatever. And the owners of those files are exactly the people who would be interested in the DRM in the first place, but they're not going to want to, if they come up with a new widget that they want a rapid prototype, they're not going to want to have to send the fingerprint of that out to some whitelist that's already been checked. So I think it's kind of a self-defeating patent in that way. I don't think we'll see it come into play for that reason. I think the people who will be using the 3D printers will be would also be the stakeholders in wanting DRM, but they're not going to want DRM.
I think that this whole DRM 3D printer scheme, it's about money. It's about getting in on the first patent. I mean, you look at Apple and how strict they are with all of their stuff with DRM and and everything. This is not necessarily about a solution that is going to work or that is needed or that is real or anything like that. It's about creating an infrastructure so that you can sell this technology and get a piece of every printer that has it, and then the people who are distributing their files, they're gonna, like you said, Voodoo, they're gonna wanna make sure that they're only distributing to people who have these DRM things in there. So it's kind of an ecosystem to an infrastructure for to implement this technology and then to profit from it, whether it actually really works or not.
Well, isn't this situation kind of similar to how laser printers have had software installed to try to prevent people from printing currencies, for instance, U.S. currency? And there are even, I think, even in Photoshop, the later versions after maybe 7, there was software changes installed to catch people trying to Photoshop currencies.
That's a really good point. Yeah, they put in some fingerprints basically in the bills themselves. So if you try to import an image file that had the specific pattern of dots, Photoshop would recognize it as currency and refuse to let you edit it.
Yeah, but there again, the stakeholder is somebody who's using a different technology. The treasury or whoever's doing the printing, the mint, they're using printing presses. They're not using laser printers, so they don't care if laser printers have this DRM. Whereas somebody who's actually creating these files, people who are making usable files, are going to want to be able to print them on their own printer without having to send them to some standards body to be checked to make sure that they're not printing something they shouldn't have.
I don't know, Voodoo, because I could easily see FedEx or Kinko's having these industrial size machines that do have the DRM chips, and a lot of manufacturers would be more than willing to use these third parties as their printing contractor. And if they have the DRM chips, why the hell would they not use them?
Well, I agree, but it's like if you were using someone as a manufacturer using 3D printing, that works. But if you're going into Kinko's and you have, I don't know, you just created a file for a coffee cup, then you would be able to print that at Kinko's. This is like saying if you put into laser printers a chip that checked the fingerprint of everything that you were printing out to make sure that you weren't printing out some novel. The people who write the novels use laser printers to print out their stuff, so why would they want a DRM chip in their printer where they would have to go out to some sort of standards body to get approval to print what they just typed?
Because they wouldn't necessarily have to do that. I'm envisioning a system where you would encrypt the file that contains the printing information with a private key, and you would put the private key on a USB drive, bring it to Kinko's, and it would read off both of the keys, and it would see, oh, hey, okay, he's got the key associated with this file. He's allowed to print it.
Well, yeah, that's the idea behind it. But what I'm saying is that people who create these files are going to want to be able to use these printers right away without going to the standards body. Yes, the file that they give you to be able to 3D print, they're going to want this, no, definitely. But the files that they themselves are printing. So in other words, there's going to have to be some sort of an escape clause in there where, okay, this file was generated by you, so therefore you can print this right in the printer. And so all you have to do is if you download whatever it was that you were going to print, you modify it just a little bit, rehash it, the fingerprint doesn't match, and so it'll allow you to print it.
This
exactly.
is this is not about the printer itself. It's only about the files. The business model behind it is to sell files of models that can't be printed. That's the only thing at play here. It's not about your printer being controlled to only print files that are DRM protected, but your printer being controlled to only print certain DRM protected files. So you can still do your own stuff, but if you buy a commercial model file from some producer, and then when you want to print it out, you shall be prevented from sharing that file, so the other person has to buy the same file. It's the same thing we have with DVDs, with PlayStation games, and so on and so on. It's the same model everywhere.
Ebooks.
List is long.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, good discussion. I guess I'm not too concerned about this, because there's always going to be guys with a little MakerBot in their garage who are going to be willing to print out, you know, I'll buy something and DDRM it and either modify it myself and rehash it, or print it out and scan it myself and go to my neighbor's garage and print another copy. So I don't think it's going to be too successful, just like the rest of the DRM schemes that I've seen.
Here, let me throw in one final point here, is living internationally over the past 10 years, I've had to deal with these stupid DVD region things where you get your DVD player from somewhere and it has some region that isn't even the region of where you're at, and you're traveling around buying DVDs with the region, you know, this whole thing. And then they tell you you can switch the DVD region inside your DVD player like 3 times and then it's expired or something like that. That was before. Now you, anywhere you go, anywhere I go outside the US, you have these DVD players that they don't even have regions on them. And on top of it, they play any format that you can think of MKV and AVI and MP4 and MP3. I mean, they play everything. So, I mean, the market basically said to these guys with their really super strict control system of these DVD regioning things, the market just said, screw this, and came out with this stuff.
Which,
you know, that plays everything.
Hero, on that note, I've got a Blu-ray player, and I recently created a DVD that had all of the regions set, because I used some off-the-shelf open source software to reduce an HD copy of a file to a standard definition so I could play it. Well, what do you know? My player, my Blu-ray player, won't accept DVDs that have all the regions enabled. It will only work if it's one region is enabled, the one that it's configured for. So you have that problem.
Smuggler, did you have any final thoughts on this topic?
No.
All right, let's move on to your topic then. And that is the International Telecommunication Union versus the Internet. So, this ITU is the UN's Communications Committee, and they're currently meeting for 2 weeks to modernize the international telecommunication regulations. And that phrase does make me die a little bit inside. So the intention of this is they want to, quote, facilitate international interconnection and interoperability of information and communication services. The treaty sets out general principles for assuring the free flow of information around the world, promoting affordable and equitable access for all, and laying the foundation for ongoing innovation and market growth. That sounds awesome. Of course, there's widespread concern that this committee is actually going to try to increase government control of the internet, limit the free flow of information, and make it easier for states to spy upon and censor their internet traffic. So I was surprised to see that the U.S. House of Representatives unanimously voted to oppose these U.N. regulations, and obviously they rarely can agree on anything, so that's, you know, kind of nice. Smuggler, are you concerned that this committee is going to harm the internet?
No, not at all. Because personally, I think the whole ITU, WCIT discussion in the media is total bunk and propaganda. I'm not a fan of the ITU, I have to say that. And I'm not a fan of any committee I ever met, and I don't think that committees work. But the whole fuzz about that is a big look somewhere else scheme. You know, it's like, here's nothing to see. You know, just look at the ITU. The problems are with the ITU. Because all the things that have been proposed to the ITU when it comes to surveillance, when it comes to disconnecting people and so on and so on, the states have been doing that for decades by now. You know, it's the ITU is not creating something new here that the states weren't able to do before that. I mean, every state has full control over the internet on its territory. If they want it, they pluck they pull the plug. You know, I mean, we had Syria disconnecting just a few days ago. You know, without the help of the ITU and without the help of the ITR treaty. So it's not introducing something new on the level of spying and stuff like that. But what it changes are two, well, maybe three big things. And those are things that most of the normal internet users will never, ever come in contact with. That is number one, it's who will be able to create new top level domains and who will give out addresses and management of addresses and so on and so on. This is currently in ICANN, which is a different body, and the regional internet registries. So they are kind of outside of government control, the multi-stakeholder project model. And that is where most of the opposition comes from the civil society, is that the ITU shall not replace ICANN. And the US government doesn't want ICANN to be replaced because, well, ICANN is a US government body. So it's under US government law, and the US has some say in it as more or less the only state. The other thing that a little bit concerns me is questions about changes in the BGP protocol, so that countries can decide where traffic from their country to another country will travel through. This is a proposal that several South African states and South American states and Arabic states are backing, because they have the issue that their traffic is traveling through the US or Israel without them being able to route around those countries. And they know that the US and Israel is spying on them like hell. So they want to make sure that their traffic is not touching enemy territory. And the last thing is that there are some proposals to introduce a different commercialization scheme to the internet. That is the sender pays model that we have from telephone. Essentially, if you call, you pay. Or on the internet, it would be if you send traffic, you pay for the traffic. Right now, cost for traffic is shared. It's every network more or less shares the traffic with every other network it is connected to, and there are individual agreements on that. Some are commercialized, some are not. Traffic is not free, but you know, you can have some nice bookkeeping tricks, which is essentially what peering is today. And the sender pays rule would essentially mean that big companies like Google or whatever would be paying much more for their traffic. That is why they are opposed to it. It's not a big thing that will hit everybody. So personally, I think this is a big distraction and blame somebody else, and you know, keeping our control that we have already and not sharing it. So personally, I think the whole thing is a big scam. Both the opposition to it and ITU itself, it's one scam, and they should all shut up, in my opinion.
Well, let's pretend that this whole committee is made of geniuses who manage to work with each other really well, and they listen to input from all the stakeholders. What could they actually do that would improve the state of the internet?
There are actually a few things of improvement that would help on the internet. One thing would be to propose that people are actively using route filtering. That is something many ISPs already do, but it's not widespread and it's not well done. And it would be nice if that would be proposed a little bit more or marketed more. But in the end, the question is who sits in front of the computer and controls it. And that is not the ITU. It's individual admins under individual laws of individual jurisdictions. So the ITU does not have any power to make the internet better. As much as no other body has the power to make the internet better. the internet is made better by a lot of people getting together cooperatively and doing something smart.
Is this route filtering the thing you were talking about a couple minutes ago, where say one nation could say, I want this packet to not be routed through the US or Israel?
No, I was talking about inbound and outbound BGP route filtering, which essentially says that you have a firewall for routing information. And the problem that we have on the internet right now is that there's a lot of false BGP traffic running around that allows stuff like disconnecting foreign networks or spying on foreign networks without going to the cable, just by sending information that says, hey, reroute the traffic, please. So that is something that is a big concern right now, and that should be solved ideally. And what should be solved is that IP addresses are faked, because that is another kind of big issue, especially when it comes to DOS attacks and stuff like that. So on the route filtering for routing information for sender IP addresses, and maybe something like a new scheme to prevent DDoS attacks, that are things that have to be done, but the ITU cannot do it, the ICANN cannot do it. It's something that will develop in the market and in the network community, and I'm talking about administrators here. I'm not talking about like the normal guy with his PC. I'm talking about the people that are running networks, and I'm pretty sure they will come up with new stuff over time and make it better.
One of the proposals that has been tossed around with regards to this ITU meeting is this idea of sender pays. And that would mean that the guy who's generating the traffic, you know, Netflix, they're the ones who have to pay for the bandwidth usage as it travels through the pipes. And I think that currently, at least in the US, the rules are towards the side of net neutrality, meaning that Netflix doesn't have to pay anything extra. And the ISPs just basically provide the pipes for any traffic without, you know, charges based
that's
on
so
bandwidth.
That's so true.
And
that's
I'm
so true.
A little bit. Go ahead.
If you are connected to the internet today, you pay more or less. You either pay by having traffic that other people are interested in, so you switch traffic with other networks. That's called peering, and that is where usually no money flows directly. But in every other case, for Netflix, for Google, and so on, what they need transit access. And that actually means they pay for bandwidth already, but they only pay the next hop. They only pay the cable they're connected to, the ISP they're connected to. They're not paying globally. So the money they pay is stuck at the first company they pay. And then the companies among each other, the network companies among each other, have transit or peering agreements, and thus distribute the money more widely. But the thing is that this is true more or less for all parties. So in the end, the money on the internet gets pretty widely distributed. It's not about net neutrality. The whole sender pay thing is not about net neutrality, because it wouldn't mean that there are different prices for different senders, but you would be paid. You would pay by traffic generated, which is already true for all those parties. However, what would change is that the distribution of the money would change, because there would be more money ending up in the far away hops of the end of the traffic transaction. So it actually means that it gets distributed more widely. And that is what the concept behind sender pay is that more people are getting money for more traffic, and especially the last mile ISPs, because the last mile ISPs are currently paying for traffic themselves because they're just bringing in customers and not so much traffic that is valuable to other networks.
Okay, so let me see if I have this here. Let's say I want to watch some Netflix. I send Netflix a request. Netflix sends the content to their ISP A, and it bounces to ISP B, to ISP C, to me. and Netflix is paying ISPA. ISPA has some peering agreements, so they may share the money with ISPB and ISPA. The sender pays model would be making sure that all three ISPs would get a cut.
Exactly. That is exactly the thing.
Okay, awesome.
Thanks
for the explanation.
Can I
go ahead, Hero.
Smuggler, you did really well in explaining how it would work, but what would be an Austrian economics analysis of what this means? I mean, what are your feelings on it? What does it mean economically? And what would be the effects of this over...
Every regulation drives up the price. So it would become more expensive to everybody, and more people would be able to specialize in just consuming traffic and not producing traffic. So I think that sender pay is, from a moral standpoint, it's a nice idea. But from the economic standpoint, there is no single reason to change anything on internet payment and how peering and transit and consumer networks work. Because the current payment system, what it really creates is an incentive for every network to both provide and consume traffic. And that makes sure that the network is evenly distributed, that there are no single hubs that specialize only on one kind of traffic. So that it's good for the stability of the network, and it's good for the prices on the network if that stays unregulated. Sender pay would lead to more specialization on certain sender traffic types, which would mean that we have more segregation on the internet, we would have more single points of failures, we would have more data factories, and it would mean that prices go up, because you have to account for all of that. You have to share the stuff, you have to transfer money, and so on and so on. So I don't think that sender pay gives us any good thing. I just say that I understand the concept behind it, and I understand why Google and so on are opposed to it, but they're making a political stance out of that is based on freedom, not on economics. And they are scamming the public with their anti-ITU propaganda, because they're mixing goals with propaganda to conceal that it's in their own interest to save money. And then they say, oh no, it's about freedom. Yes, it is about freedom, but not in the way they propose it.
I don't think Google is opposed to it. They may say they are, but I don't think they are, because I think sender pays ends up being a barrier to entry for new applications, for new service providers. And that Google and Netflix would be happy to have those
barriers. No, I totally disagree. Because right now, Google and Netflix and so on, they're in a better position compared to sender pay, because they actually produce a lot of traffic already. That is, they have a better margin on their connections. They have the money to pay their own leased lines, to have their own MPLS rents and so on, which is something smaller companies cannot do, because it easily runs up into several hundred thousand euros. With sender pays, all that scale position that Google and so on has would disappear. And what they would fall back on is to be treated as a sender, as a producer only, like everybody else. So essentially, all the investments that Google and so on and Netflix and so on did in their own distribution networks and their own fiber and so on, they would lose that investment. So I actually think that Google and so on, they want the current system, because the current system makes their position more stable than the sender pay system.
All right, let me try and understand this. So in my previous three ISP examples, we have Netflix communicating with ISPA, and ISPA is the one they're paying. And ISPA is actually, they have a special deal with Netflix. Either Netflix bought a data center and they're routing it themselves, or they have some sort of contract. And you're saying that under the sender pay system, the total cost of Netflix having to pay ISPA, B, and C is going to be greater than their current cost of paying just ISPA. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Okay.
you know, one of the things, one of the, like a lot of ideas in like socialism and some other economic ideologies, they come up with this idea of like, oh, it'd be better if everybody, you know, paid lower prices. And then they say, oh, so therefore we're going to set the prices as low. And the idea is not to get an individual's cost down. The idea is to get the entire sector's overhead and costs and the to provide the service down low, not just like setting the price and ignoring the actual cost. So the sender pay thing, though, you know, when you said, Smuggler, that you can understand some of the goals with some of it, but that we already have the market already has options for that, and that would be if I'm living in the Sahara in Africa and go and I want to watch Netflix. Okay, you know, I do have sender pay, and that's this. I pay a certain amount of money to Netflix, and that money trickles down through all the peering agreements one way or another. And if my local ISP does not provide doesn't have the bandwidth, and they're like, well, we don't have the bandwidth to cover all of this stuff. That's what I pay my ISP rates for. That's why I choose alternate ISPs in my area, and I put out an extra $10 to get an extra 2 megabits or whatever like that. So I think that the market can solve this problem of a sender pay through the current infrastructure.
Okay, so I guess in Hero's case, if his ISP, ISP-C, if that doesn't have the bandwidth, Hero's going to switch to ISP-D, and that means that ISP-C is no longer routing his Netflix traffic, and they don't get a cut of it, right?
They won't get a cut of my ISP payment that I pay every month.
I see. Yeah. Okay. Go ahead, Smuggler.
The thing really is just to come back to why people want sender pay and why they want to change peering is the current peering model, which is transit networks, which is, you know, they just give take traffic and give it to someone else and open the whole internet to you. Your local ISP is essentially someone who's offering transit services. Then you have the peering, which is networks that are kind of equal in that they both provide and consume traffic. So they deal with each other and say, you know what, we just exchange traffic, no money flows. And then you have the consumer, which is traffic producer networks that don't consume traffic. So those are the three rates, so to speak. And we currently have a system, the peering and transit and consumer network system, that actually wants or incentivizes people to be all three. On the internet, the best position you can have is that you both consume and transit network. And together you become a peer, so you have less costs. So that means that all the consuming and producing of traffic is widely distributed. That is what the current system incentivizes. And that is what the internet was built for in the original. And then ISPs, commercial ISPs came in. And commercial ISPs that do last line connections are, they're only, so to speak, consumers. They only have people with their private computers there that download stuff, but those private computers offer nothing to the internet. So the last line people are kinda out of the game because they have to pay a lot of transit fees to other people because they produce nothing internally. They cannot deal on a peering agreement. And it is that specialization that drives those ISPs to ask for sender pay. And you can see that in those people that want it. It's last line ISPs from Europe that want sender pay because it will allow them to still be specialized on last line only and still get money back and not just paying for consuming traffic. So it's more or less something to keep a certain kind of specialization that is against the nature of the internet to get that running.
Well, let's not forget that these last line providers are also the ones that are collecting all this cash that all of us ISP subscribers are dumping on them, and they're working within that market.
Wait a second. So if I can cut in here for a moment. So I'm connected on a cable system right now. And the cable provider, of course, is I'm paying fees to that cable provider in order to get service. Now, those cable providers also are trying to sell me content. And because of that, they don't like peer-to-peer arrangements because it allows me to download stuff and share with other people, et cetera, et cetera. However, it seems to me under the current arrangement that they'd want to encourage people to do peer-to-peer because then those people would be sending stuff upstream and they would be content providers in essence. Now, under the new arrangement, if it went through with sender pays, that would change the entire ballgame and would probably disincentivize people or the content or the content, the cable companies from
well, it kind of depends on how big the ISP is. If the ISP is very small, then the local peer-to-peer producers are not enough to cover all the transit costs. So it really depends. And the other thing with P2P is that it produces a high legal risk on the ISPs, and that reduces the profit itself. So the real thing that ISPs want is they don't want to be any producers at all, because producing is expensive. They only want to consume traffic. But that alone doesn't pay the bills. So they have to make the producers pay extra so that the consumer networks get enough money. So it's actually a scheme that wants to recreate the television broadcast model on the internet again.
All right. Thanks, everybody, because this is enlightening to me. I didn't understand most of this stuff already, and I apologize to any listeners who don't like the understanding the technical aspects of ISPs and internet and stuff. So we'll end that discussion there. I want to take just a brief moment for some plugs. So Voodoo is still running blackandyellowpages.com, and that's an agorist business directory. So if you are interested in selling some services, you can go on there and get an account and advertise your services to your local community. And you can also take a look and see what people have to offer in your area. Smugglers ShadowLife.cc is awesome. He's got really, 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 really great articles on there. So subscribe to his RSS and keep an eye out for all your digital privacy and et cetera needs. Wise guy.
No. Actually, I am working on a number of different things, but as usual, almost all of my stuff is gray market or black, gray or black, and so anything that happens will not happen under my name.
Fair enough. So Hero is operating agorisradio.com. Thanks again for hosting all our episodes of Reality Exploit Roundtable. You can also take a look at his other shows, including Cypherpunked, which is a great collection of interviews on cypherpunk topics, and Coinbase episodes if you want some Bitcoin news. Hero is also operating orlingrab.com, which is a really great news site. That's orlingrabbe.com. As to myself, I don't have any public projects right now, so I will leave you with my two favorite webcomics, which are xkcd.com and smbc-comics.com. That brings us to our fourth and final topic, Iranian and Grecian black markets. Pundits say that Greece has got themselves into their mess in the Eurozone by trading on the black market instead of properly paying their taxes. Friedrich Schneider, a professor at the Johannes Kepler Institute in Linz, Austria, disagrees. He believes that up to half of Greece's shadowy economy complements activities in the official economy, adding to welfare and overall GDP. He also thinks that stamping out the black market would do more harm than good. Now, leaving aside the difficulties of stamping out black markets, it seems to me that more money circulating through the shadow economy will eventually make it back into the legal white markets, at which point the Greek government can collect tax. And it also seems to me that if the black market distributes resources more efficiently than the white market, it means that the guys using the black market can get more stuff for less money. And they'll prosper more if they use the black market than the white market. And to me, that having individuals prospering is a whole lot more important than having the state prospering. So a couple countries away, Iranians are starting to discover Bitcoin. Users are using directories of OTC exchanges to turn their Iranian rials into Bitcoins. That helps them bypass sanctions and store wealth. Musician Mohammed Rafiq is one of the early adopters. He's selling his tracks on CoinDL, and we'll play one of those at the end of the show. So Hero, I mean, these guys are abandoning the white market and moving to more profitable black market paradigms. So do you have any trade craft tips that will help them reduce risk?
Yeah, just a couple of comments that will lead into that is there's been a straw man. Well, back to the Iranian thing. There's an article we'll have linked to in Bloomberg Business Week that talks about the problems that the Iranians are having with the sanctions and their currency rate for dollars and stuff going crazy, and people trying to get a hold of dollars, and how that many of them are turning to Bitcoin. So one of the straw men that I've heard in the past when it has been suggested that Iranians specifically look into using Bitcoin was that the Iranians don't need Bitcoin and they can't use Bitcoin because they paint this picture as if an Iranian citizen inside the Iranian country needs to somehow get a hold of Bitcoins, and then he's going to get online and he's going to go to some e-commerce website and he's going to buy something for Bitcoins. And the Bitcoins that whole argument falls down when you actually start seeing how Bitcoins in the Bitcoin network can be used. And in this article, it's an excellent article because they actually talk on some of it, is that someone can take their reals?
Yep.
Yeah, they can take their reals, okay, and or U.S. dollars, because Iranians have U.S. dollar holdings throughout the world, and they have relatives that are throughout the world, and business contacts and the like. So someone inside of Iran who has money owed to them, they actually are requesting that people pay them for programming services in Bitcoins. So whether it's at a dollar rate or euro rate or whatever, then at that moment their dollars are held inside of the Bitcoin network, and it doesn't matter whether they have a hard time getting hold of dollars, they're actually frozen like holding a foreign account. So back to the tradecraft thing is that someone inside of Iran can receive money for services that they are performing internationally, electronically, or if someone owes them money outside of the country or they have U.S. dollar holdings in some other bank, they can remotely transfer those dollars over to a Bitcoin exchanger or someone who's purchasing and then hold those Bitcoins. And then they can exchange those with people within their country, within Iran, between each other, for at the whatever the current dollar rates are. So the advantages of that for them is just something way beyond anyone saying, well, we're going to get Bitcoins and then we're going to buy something on an e-merchant's website. So now one of the things that I thought that this tied into a little bit roughly was the opium wars, when you read about Great Britain and China and what happened with their injection of opium and trying to settle their trade deficits and the like, was that the opium was never purchased in China. So it wasn't like they came up to the ports and there were guys there with loads of cash who would and they would exchange and purchase the opium. The opium was actually purchased outside of the country in typically one of the larger places was on these exchanges in India. So the only thing that needed to be done was that the goods needed to be dropped off after they were already bought and paid for. So similar things can happen inside of the Iranian company with things inside of the Iranian country for a lot of goods and things that are coming into the country legally or illegally, is that trades and settlement can happen outside the country. Even if the person who's bringing it in needs dollars, that's okay. You can use your Bitcoins to make the transfer over to dollars, the payment is made, and then the goods can be delivered inside the country. So, and then back to the, real quick on the the Greek thing. with the black market economy there. I think that there's two problems that a lot of people look at this crisis as just being this like singular thing. But there's one crisis where you have the government has borrowed so much money and it owes this money and it's having a hard time paying it back. And then you have the other crisis, which is what most of the people in the streets are writing about. They're not writing about the inability to pay back some big bank, a European bank. They're rioting because they want more benefits. So the more that people are evading taxes or are not paying taxes, sure, that's going to cut back on the revenues and that's going to cut back on the benefits that are going out. So you kind of have sort of a multiple personality thing going on in Greece, where it seems like so many of the people, they want all of the services, they want all of the union and pension things all set high by the government, and public services and schooling, you know, benefits and all these things. They want all of it, but at the same time, they don't want to pay for it. They just want, you know, rich people to pay for it. So I think that this article that brought up a good point, that the black market economy, I'll read the first thing here. Berlin taxi drivers tend to argue that if Greeks paid their taxes, the Eurozone would be in less of a pickle. But that line of thought may be wrong. Greece's shadow economy, the activities of those who pay neither tax nor social insurance, seems to be something of a safety net preventing the country from going into freefall. And I think that that says a lot there.
Somehow I don't think the U.S. government got the memo that if they're not getting revenue in, they got to cut back on the services going out. Anyway, anyone else have comments on Tradecraft for Greeks and Iranians, or other comments on their situations?
Yeah, I do. One of the things that's been going on since Iran came under this tremendous pressure by using the banking system to exclude them is how does Iran get paid for its oil? How does it export its oil, and how does it get paid? Normally, of course, all of those things would move through the world banking system, much of it operating through New York City. So what's been going on lately is that the Iranians have been delivering their oil and getting paid in Turkish lira, probably delivering it in Turkey since it's nearby. And then they've been taking the lira and converting it to gold and gold ingots, gold coins, I think gold blocks, you know, 400-ounce bars. And they've been taking those to the UAE, where they can still bring things into Iran. So there's this trade now between oil to lira to gold and back to Iran. It would seem to me that it would behoove the Iranian companies to cut out the gold transport, which is risky, and then convert the liras directly to Bitcoin at the source in Turkey, and then use Bitcoin from then on. Of course, you know that most of the people in these companies are extremely conservative and very old, and they probably couldn't even think about using another currency. But that would be a huge benefit, I believe, for Iran to cut out the gold trade as part of their oil, business.
Well, I'd like to comment on several things here. That we crossed a lot of topics right here. Number one, I'd like to comment on you, Wise Guy. The motive for paying or receiving gold for oil that is exported is actually not so much to smuggle the oil, the gold back into Iran. What Iran has been doing for the last 20 years minimum is to set up a widely distributed network of companies that procure all kinds of stuff, bypassing the sanctions. So what's actually happening is that the profits from the oil get converted to gold. The gold is smuggled to other companies in countries outside of Iran to then be converted and used in purchases that are then smuggled back to Iran. That's been how the Iranian foreign economy has been working for at least 20 years. It's mostly run by the state intelligence agencies. They are essentially the public traders when it comes to Iran. Within Iran, the gold is actually not very much needed. The gold is just needed to make purchases outside of Iran. And that is something that the intelligence agencies do and have been doing for quite a while. The other thing I wanted to comment on is the Greek issue. First, tradecraft for Greek shadow economy merchants is, number one, don't use your name. Number two, don't use your home when you do it. Number three, use cash or something like that. The whole thing about tradecraft and a widely spread black market, it's not all those fancy don't be followed and drop points and all that stuff. The only thing you really want to do is to limit the amount of evidence people get about you and to make yourself less vulnerable by being stolen from by the government or other people on the market. So protect your home. Don't work from your home. If you're trading something, don't let customers come to your home and give them the stuff, but instead meet them. Usually what happens is that local street fairs are springing up everywhere where people trade and take part in that, and take a gold or a Bitcoin or cash. Don't take wires, don't take credit cards or stuff like that, because that will immediately give away your tax debts. And also, if you purchase raw materials, purchase them cash. Don't leave too many trails in the banking systems that then would be used against you. But I also wanted to comment on Hero, on the motive for people rioting on the street. And that is something that has been overlooked, I think, a lot in the media. And that is the public spending ratio in most European countries is pretty high. So you have like 40, 50, 60% of the gross national product that is actually the government expenditures that come from taxes and foreign aid and loans and whatever. So essentially, when the government has to stop paying or stop making debt, is that they stop paying people that are part of the economy. And I'm not just talking about teachers and welfare. I'm talking about companies, state-owned companies that get less money. So the real issue here is that nations that have a high public spending ratio are very, very vulnerable to debt crises, because all the economy or a large part of the economy is affected when the state is not a consumer anymore and not a manager anymore. So all those people are on the street because actually they don't get money for their work, or some at least are on the street because they don't get money for the work anymore because the state is their employer. And this is not just about welfare. It's about the states being stupid enough to think that they should be a player in the economy.
Awesome. Thanks, Smuggler.
You know, yeah, great.
Go ahead, Voodoo.
What both of these stories illustrate is that it's a complete mistake to talk about the economy or the market or the black market or the shadow economy. These are individuals who are working and playing in these environments, and each one of them is their own economy. They are their own markets, or, you know, two of them to get together, they are the market. In Greece, you have some small players on the black market, maybe the shadow economy. You've got the guy that's selling euros on the corner or whatever. But then you've got the not cartel leaders, but whatever the Greek mafia would be. Those guys have the money to pay off politicians, judges, cops, whatever. So there is some sort of economy of scale there. And the idea of whether or not it would be beneficial to shut down that black market or shut down that shadow economy, you have to distinguish between the big players that are feeding into the corruption and the small guys that are, you know, jitney cab or the guy selling euros on the corner who doesn't have a license. Those small guys have a very high velocity of money. The money that comes in, they turn right back out. They are without a doubt a net benefit. But I would argue the bigger guys are actually is not something that anybody should be applauding, because they're adding to the corruption. And I know this is controversial, but in that sense, I think the black market actually adds to the state. It makes the state stronger. The state can do all sorts of messing around and idiotic moves, the black market is there to pick up the slack, to make sure people have food and that kind of stuff, so that they're not rioting in the streets. I think if you know, without those big cartels, people would be rioting more often. Certainly in the United States, that's the case. We prop up the politicians and law enforcement. They prop up the big cartels, the big gangs, but they go after the guy who's trying to help somebody rewire their kitchen for not having their contractor's license. And then the other story with Iran, again, who's accepting the Bitcoin? Is it somebody on the street? Is it you know, some big corporation? I think you have two separate economies there. What I do disagree with this article, and if you note, if you read the article carefully, they say something about stable price of Bitcoin. Yeah, stable price of Bitcoin as compared to the U.S. dollar. But exactly. If these sanctions are working, then the Bitcoin inflation should be, price inflation should be happening just as fast as dollar inflation, and just as fast as real. Actually, it would be a price deflation, because the real against Bitcoin should be a proxy for real against the dollar. So I'm not buying that Bitcoin is some sort of panacea to help get cheaper chicken to the guy on the street in Iran. The key is getting rid of these stupid sanctions and treating these people as people. And if you want to have, you know, some sort of sanctions against the government, make them government sanctions, not sanctions against the people with food and medicines and such.
Well, isn't that what happened in Iraq? I mean, the United States pursued a policy of controlling the types of goods and materials that flowed in under Saddam's regime, and as a result, hundreds of thousands of Iraqis apparently were starved to death or died.
Yeah, but if you ask Madeleine Albright, it was worth it, because it was the peasants who were dying. It was the plebeians who were dying. It wasn't her, you know, her circle of plutocrats and such. So, yeah, these sanctions are horrible. They're just completely horrible. You know, sanctions against Gaza and the West Bank, same thing. You're hurting the little folks, but the politically connected, they're not hurt at all by any of these sanctions.
All right. On that note, I think I'm going to cut it off and end the show. We're getting well over an hour, so thanks everybody for listening to this Reality Exploit Roundtable episode 14. As I said before, we got a song for you. This is by Iranian artist Mohammad Rafiq. It's from his album Beyond Matter. It's called For Brightness. You can download his tracks for just a few bit cents each. You can grab the link from our show notes or search Google for CoinDL Beyond Matter. Thanks for listening.